This was a lot of fun. Welcome to another episode of Heretics. This is another part of my New York tour, and this is Batya Unger Sargon, the opinion editor of Newsweek and the author of Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. But she also has just released a new book, which I read and found absolutely brilliant and fascinating, called Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And it's just absolutely mind-blowing and points out so many of the hypocrisies that I've been sort of angling at, and you guys have been also maybe exposing or at least suspecting. This idea of this incredibly overeducated elite group of journalists who are not actually acting in the favor, not actually acting in the interest of the working class people of the states. And, you know, we have this all around the world, of course. And these kinds of people are able to make themselves really feel and look as though they are doing good and are looking after those who actually need help or leg up or anything like that, when in actual fact they are only representing the interests of themselves. So do please go out and get hold of Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. It's a really, really good book. She's a great writer. That's Batya Unger Sargon. And give her a follow on Twitter or X and all of those kinds of things. If you're getting a couple of books, get The Psychology of Secrets: My Adventures with Murderers, Cults, and Influencers. It's got almost entirely five-star reviews. Thank you so much, guys, for doing that. Please do review it. If you've read it or heard it on Audible, just go to amazon.co.uk and give it a big review there. I would appreciate it very much. But I will see you at the end. Batya Unger Sargon. There's an audio file that gets sent to me that everyone gets sent with how to pronounce your name.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it goes in the email.
From who?
Your assistant. I don't want to get them in trouble.
I don't have an assistant.
Exactly.
It's very weird because I have many, many siblings, and none of my siblings say my last name the way that they say our last name the way I do. My parents don't say it the same. So I'm very curious to find out how it's being recommended.
It was shown as Batya Unger Sargon because I would have said Unger.
Oh, interesting.
The media went from underclass to the right. We're having a giggly moment because I've just met Batya, and it's been a whirlwind of fire, a baptism of fire. The media went from underclass to woke elite. How the fuck did that happen?
Okay, wait, say it again. The media went from underclass to woke elite. Yes. The history of journalism in America is very interesting because for much of the 20th century, the 19th century, journalism was produced by working class people for working class people. It was produced for the masses, and all of the business incentives and motives behind that were you should get the most amount of readers because then you'll make the most amount of money. And the way to do that is to write about things that mattered to them. So, for example, if you were a communist, you know, in New York City in the 1920s, you would have had like 8 communist newspapers to choose from because the papers reflected where the masses were at, what kind of point of view they had. They told stories about working class people, and they gave them a real dignity in doing so. And they shaped American policy, because if you were going to go against the masses, against labor, I mean, you were going to get eviscerated in the papers. Of course, there were papers for the elites. You know, New York Times has always catered to like a more elite clientele. But overall, in general, you know, the papers and the journalism culture was you get the most amount of readers by talking to the most amount of people, and most people are working class. And that was who journalism was produced for. And all of that started to shift kind of in the post-war era. You know, there were cultural shifts in America happening. There were economic shifts in America happening to where the cultural elite started to really separate out from the working class geographically, economically, culturally. And as a result of this, journalists increasingly came from the elites, and their views started to increasingly reflect those leftist elites whose views are very much at odds with where the average working class person is, whether they're a liberal or a conservative. conservative. As a result, we now have a situation where the vast majority of our journalism is produced by people with ridiculous numbers of degrees, like myself, from ridiculous institutions where they're taught ridiculous, stupid things that have nothing to do with how to become a good journalist. And as a result of that, the media very much caters to that economic and cultural elite. And that's, I argue in my book, that's why the media is not actually characterized by being left, like I'm left. The media is woke. And wokeness is having these extremist views about race and gender and the world that are rooted in an oppressor-oppressed binary. It is totally alien to American culture. It's totally alien to the working class of all races. But it is how the elites got away with this abandonment of labor while still seeing themselves as the good guys. So in a long, you know, that's kind of the... story.
I can't believe how well you transitioned from joking about silly things into a really succinct and perfectly put bit about well, exactly what I asked, from the underclass to the woke elite. And you're right that journalists are the most overeducated profession in the US. Is that like a statistic, or is it just like a, it seems that way?
Oh, no, that's a statistic, yeah.
How do you measure overeducatedness?
They are the most degreed, the most credentialed industry in America. Mm. And this despite the fact that for the vast majority of American history, journalists did not have a college degree. So in 1930, only a third of journalists had a college degree. Like what? They don't actually learn journalism when you go to journalism school.
Yeah.
You know, these people with multiple degrees in economics, like that, how does that make you a better journalist? It doesn't. Journalism, the job is to write the first draft of American history, the great American story. And the most important thing to have in your character when you're doing that is humility. And that is the one thing that they are certain to leave an elite university situation without.
Yeah. How many, so what ones do you, because you're a journalist.
I am.
What things do you have, degree things?
What are my degrees in? You want me to list my shame?
Are they just loads of them?
I'm intrigued. Like, sit here.
Well,
and
okay,
like...
I've got a whole bunch of them as well. Uh-huh. And like some of the stuff we had to do was like shorthand. Like, you know, you learn this different language of dots and beeps and things.
You learned that? I didn't learn that.
I didn't learn that.
Like, do you use it? Sounds like a really useful skill, actually.
Well, I was going to say it's incredibly useless because we've got audio tapes, but you're not allowed to take them into court. So that's the point. You're supposed to be able to write really, really fast in the binary dots and slashes and things. But, you know, that's one of the things I think is mad. And how would one learn journalism? I suppose what you're saying, you learn to have some humility and reflect better the aspirations of the working person.
Yeah, I mean, just knowing what normal people think and what they want to know from people in power. Like, as journalists, we get access to people in power. And what it used to be was what we would do with that access was, okay, if you were a journalist, you know, you came from a working class background, you came from a working class neighborhood, you saw yourself as answerable to like all of the guys in your class who went to work in the factory. And you couldn't go work in the factory because let's say you had a real problem with authority. You know, let's say you had an abusive dad. You couldn't take orders. They were like, he can't come to the factory. He's going to put everyone in danger. All right, fine. I'll go become a journalist, right? Like that's kind of how it worked. The guy who was like always cracking wise at the teacher's expense, getting kicked out of class. Like that's the kind of person who would become a journalist. Someone who hated power and hated authority and hated people who had it and was always thinking about his friends on the line and how can I make their life better? And so he would go to Washington and they were proud of the fact that the politicians hated their guts because they were representing their working class friends and neighbors. Tate's the exact opposite. The kind of person who becomes a journalist is the kid like sitting in the front of the classroom, like every time the teacher asks a question, me, you know, the teacher has to pretend they don't see them so other kids get a chance. They are very comfortable with authority. They go to one university and then another university where they sit there becoming teacher's pet after teacher's pet. To become a journalist is very hard now because the industry has shrunk. So the people hiring can have their pick of the, and instead of being like, oh, you know, we have 10,000 applicants, we're going to go into Appalachia or we're going to go to the inner city and find that black kid living between gang territory and bring him in to get that perspective and teach him the ropes on the job, they get the kid from Harvard because that's what they've decided to do. So who goes to Harvard? Who graduates from Harvard with 2 degrees and a degree in economics? I mean, it's like the kid in the front.
Boring.
That, Well, and who loves authority, who never met an authority figure they didn't want to impress, they now live in the same neighborhoods as the billionaires and the politicians who they're supposed to be covering adversarially. Their kids go to the same fancy schools. Like, that whole adversarial mindset is gone. And there's been just a consolidation of, you know, basically elite solidarity.
It's something particularly insidious with that happening to the left wing. I think in the UK, the Guardian, the New York Times here, I suppose, that now it's the rich, pompous, posh people like me who are going in and working for those institutions. I mean, they shouldn't have me because I am from a posh background. They shouldn't have me, except for the fact that I hate authoritarianism and authority and things like that. But they should have people, as you say, who actually reflect the views of the people there. It's disgusting, actually, the more I think about it. That there's all these sort of posh, rich people going to work for these ultra left-wing newspapers and then taking the focus away from working class people.
It's so much worse than that, because what they've done is it's so gross, but they create an ideology that allowed them to plunder the middle class. Right? The top 20% now, these over-credentialed college elites now control over 50% of the GDP in America. So they've plundered the middle class while pretending that they are the good guys on the side of justice. And you can go down the list of priorities of, like, you know, the average New York Times writer. First of all, it's totally obvious what side they're on in every situation. But in every single case, they are masquerading as the good guys on the side of justice while actually making the lives of working class Americans of all races infinitely worse. And I could just give you a million examples. I'll just start with immigration, right? There's this, you know, the ideology now on the left, from the college credential to left, is that basically we should have an open border. We should decriminalize illegal border crossing. It's racist to want to have a border. Mm-hmm. Like, any desperate person from around the world, the globe, should be allowed to come here and pursue the American dream. And they act like these people are refugees. These people are asylum seekers. They use a vocabulary of virtue and morality to talk about it, and they call working class people racist when they object to this. But the truth is that this is an economic divide, because those elites are the consumers of cheap labor. Of course they want a slave caste here, imported from failed socialist states, to service them in restaurants and service them in their homes. And meanwhile, it's working class people who are literally paying for it. It is wage theft of the working class, because all of those migrants are competing with working class people for jobs. So they sit there and pretend this is about morality, when actually they are plundering the pocketbooks of the working class. And to hide that, they call them racist. That is the move, again and again and again. You saw this with the George Floyd stuff in 2020. You see this with they do it with the Green New Deal crap. Their whole agenda is class warfare against the working class, but dressed up in this woke vocabulary as though they are the heroes and they're on the side of the little guy.
Did you see when Kelly Osbourne said the quiet bit out loud?
Yes, exactly.
What did she say for those who didn't?
She said, well, if we close the border, who's going to clean our toilets? And if people are interested in knowing more about this, you can read my book, Second Class, because the idea is that nobody could possibly want to clean toilets for a living. No one could get dignity from doing that.
I don't want to clean toilets for a living.
I mean, okay.
You don't want to. Few people should have that as an aspiration, I'm just saying.
Why not?
Because you could do things that earn more money and give you more purpose in life. I'm not saying, look, some people have to do it, you know? That's it. And it's better than not having a job.
Well, for my book, Second Class, I traveled around the country interviewing working class people from all walks of life, from all political persuasions, in many, many industries. I spoke to a lot of people who clean toilets for a living who get a lot of dignity out of doing that.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. We're extremely lucky that our country is full of people who get dignity from cleaning the diapers of old people, or cleaning toilets.
That's true.
Or sitting in traffic in trucks delivering our goods, or driving us places in Ubers. Like, our society relies on the labor of a lot of people who maybe don't find their jobs to be the most stimulating part of their life, but are extremely patient and still get a lot of dignity from it. And it is elites like yourself who think that nobody could possibly get any dignity out of this. And that's because we have degraded the kind of life that these jobs can give somebody. What makes a job dignified or not is not how smelly it is. It's whether it can get somebody the American dream, a stable life that they can support a family on. And honestly, like, that's the fault of the elites, because they took an economy in which you could be in the service industry and you could make a decent living and you could support a family and get a lot of dignity out of that. And they drove down the wages with mass immigration, with trade deals, with defunding vocational training. And they, and now it's impossible to make it while doing those jobs, but those jobs are no less dignified in terms of the labor than they were in the 70s.
Sure, but they're not well, as you say, they're not well paid. I mean,
but
that's the principle.
That was very intentional. They were much well paid in the 70s, and now they're not, because of mass immigration and trade deals and offshoring of manufacturing and, you know, all of these policies that leftist elites put in place on this idea that everybody should go to college and everybody should become a podcaster, you know? Well, not everybody wants to be a podcaster, Andrew. I know that this is very hard for some people
just,
to
just to clarify, it's not the work itself necessarily of the toilet cleaning that that is the issue. I think part of it is the fact that it's not a well-paid job. I mean, if that was a job that paid $200,000 a year, then people would be queuing up for it, I think. So I agree with what you're saying. Unfortunately, it's just not a well-paid job. It is also just, it's a bit smelly. It's not great.
I mean, so is being a doctor.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't do it. I get a lot of it.
It's not undignified, right? Nobody would accept that.
No, but it's just not a job I would do. I wouldn't want to be a proctologist.
Right.
A lot of people want to be proctologists.
A lot of people want to be proctologists.
What's that about? I wouldn't trust a gynecologist, a male gynecologist.
Really?
Yeah, I wouldn't. A lot of women don't want to see a male gynecologist.
You think? Because they can't separate that he's a man?
The man can't separate that he's a man.
Oh, that's very interesting. So you mean a gay man you would trust? A gay gynecologist you would trust?
If I saw him out with his boyfriend the night before. Yeah, I think so.
Oh, otherwise you wouldn't trust that he was gay. You'd be like, this is just a, he's putting it on.
For anyone wondering why I'm being particularly cheeky in this episode, it's because Batya said she spoke, she's already done 3 or 4 interviews today. So I'm making an effort to be controversial.
And I'm sorry, I really shouldn't have said that.
I have to be ridiculous and controversial to keep you concentrating.
It's your fault, because you said that that's a central facet of your personality.
What?
Is that
luring fun out of people?
Yeah.
One has to, doesn't one? One has to. Okay, so we're at a point now where jobs have been degraded.
Yeah.
And earn much less money than they used to.
But
and
on
we're at a
purpose.
Point we could so we have to sort of bring in immigrants under this sort of Kelly Osbourne philosophy of they'll clean our toilets finally.
Yeah. Who's gonna pick the crops? You have hipsters, right? Mm. Buying plots of land upstate, you know, becoming subsistence farmers, right? Nobody says that's not dignified. It's not undignified to be a farmer. It's undignified to do labor in an economy that has been plundered by the college credentialed and upward transfer of wealth into their pockets at the expense of the working class. That, and it was all intentional. Like, it was all done piece by piece by piece by piece. That's the argument.
With what aim?
With what aim? What do you mean? What, you think this
Why was this done?
Why would people take an economy in which there was a lot of equality and shove 50% of the GDP into their own pockets? Why would they do that? Are you really asking me that?
I'm asking you to explain how that works.
How it happened or why it happened? Why they wanted to be richer?
How why it makes they wanted them richer. To control? How it makes people richer.
Oh, sorry. Okay. You didn't mean like why people would want to like plunder the middle class and put the money in their own pockets.
I didn't even know that's why this is happening. So so just so explain that.
In 1971, which is the high water mark for working class wages, the biggest share of the economy was in the middle class. That was like the biggest chunk of the GDP was in the middle. Today, the top 20% controls over 50% of the GDP. So they've plundered that middle for themselves. There's been a squeeze upwards, and working class people have been squeezed down. The top 20% likes to rail against the billionaires, you know?
Okay.
Like Bernie Sanders used to be, well, okay, before he was a millionaire, he used to be like the millionaires and the billionaires.
Yeah.
And now, of course, he's a millionaire. Thank you. And now it's all the billionaires and the billionaires, you know? Like, okay, fair enough. But I don't hold it against him. But the billionaire class as a class, the share of the economy that they control has not actually significantly changed since the 70s. Mm. It's everybody below them. It's the top 20% who have truly plundered the middle class. And they did that through a series of policies that were put in place. First, you had, you know, Bill Clinton with NAFTA. Do you know what NAFTA is?
Racing. No, oil. That's NASCAR. oil, isn't it? NAFTA means Spanish for petrol.
NAFTA was a trade deal signed into law by Democratic President Bill Clinton that shipped 5 million very good manufacturing jobs overseas to China and Mexico to build up their middle class. And then President Obama showed up and defunded vocational training. So we used to have a very robust, skilled trade sort of sector of the economy. So manufacturing and the skilled trades are two very robust avenues to the middle class for working class people, to the American dream. So those were both destroyed by Democratic presidents. And then just mass migration. So in 1971, this year, the high water mark for working class wages, the share of the population that was foreign born, that was immigrant, was 4%. Today, it's about 16%. And the majority of those people, upward of 60%, work in working class jobs. They work in jobs that don't require a college degree or a command of the English language. And so, of course, they're competing with working class people. And so each of these stages, you know, increased this sort of divide, the class divide between the college educated and the working class. And now that it's that divide is a real gulf. So if you have a college degree in America, you will make on average $1.2 million more throughout the course of your career. You will live longer. You will be much healthier. You're much more likely to become a homeowner, and your life is protected from the kind of deaths of despair and downward mobility that are plaguing working class America.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in four of their best-selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, two carry-on sizes, two checked sizes, four colours, black, blue, pink, grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded, both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favorite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
My God. So just to summarize this, is this immigrants? What was so funny? They're immigrants.
You said that like you were joking.
My God. That's just my voice. I sound like I'm like a cartoon in this country. Everybody's, whenever I say things, everyone's like, is he serious? Oh my God. Is he British? Immigrants have come over. Mm-hmm. They've been welcomed over. In some respects, that's a good thing, right? But what you're saying is that they've been able to work maybe for lower salaries, which has forced the working class down and made a bigger divide.
That's
pretty scary for the working class, isn't it? So
I mean, a lot of this is the same thing that happened with Brexit, you know, like the working class was very clear about where they stood on this, and the elites were all, I mean, wasn't there a kind of elite working class divide over Brexit?
Yes.
Yeah. Similar thing.
Yes. I was a Remainer, but, you know, I understood democracy and we lost, and so that was that. But everybody suddenly, and we've seen that time and time again, haven't we, that people, when they've lost, the people who are on the left, the woke, they've started to undermine democracy when they don't get their way.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. To be fair, Trump's, you know, could be accused of the same thing. I guess everybody just wants to win, don't they, on both sides?
Yeah. Hmm. I like winning. Do you?
I like winning, but I wouldn't want to undermine democracy.
No, me neither. No.
So that's the thing. The Brexit thing was mad because we had so many, you know, friends of mine, university students and things who were all Remainers and stuff. And the assumption was that everybody who wanted to leave Europe must have been racist and stupid and horrible.
It's exactly the same. Did you know anyone socially who was a Brexiteer? Is that the right word?
Yeah, that's right. No, hardly any, like one or two people. But we've also got this.
But they
thing.
Were probably like posh conservatives. No, they were.
That's the
like
thing. That's the thing.
Working class people. Yeah.
Yeah. It's that. It's that side. And so, you know, but it's a funny thing to see the working class gradually in the UK and the US start to vote right, and the
totally.
You know, the posh liberals voting left.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The whole thing's flipped on its head, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. In America now, we've seen like a total realignment. Like the working class used to be the Democrats used to represent the working class. And now the 9 of the 10 richest counties in America are controlled by Democrats. 65% of people who make over $500,000 a year are Democrats. Wall Street gave more money to Joe Biden than to Donald Trump. 97% of donations coming out of Silicon Valley go to Democrats. 96% of journalists are Democrats. Like, there's been a total realignment. And the majority of people making under 50% of the median income now live in districts controlled by Republicans. So the working class is really Republican, and the Democrats are now the party of the rich and the dependent poor. And I think this is a piece that's missed on people. You know, people always say, like, well, the Democrats must be the good guys because they support raising taxes, you know? And it's like, yeah, it's like an indulgence they're paying. Like, they're so much richer than the working class. And, you know, instead of having a sense of, like, noblesse oblige, like the nobility used to have, you know, the sense of, like, well, we must, you know, a humility vis-a-vis the God that gave you so much better fortune than somebody else. Like, let's, you know, do something for the people around. They now instead have this, like, meritocratic view. Like, they think that their good fortune is the result of their hard work and their innate talent. And they don't see, like, all of the structural advantages that they've had. And as a result, what they want is just to pay off, like, to pay it off. Like, and it's wild because working class people do not want higher taxes. They don't want the taxes of the rich. They don't see themselves as, like, on a par with poor people.
Sure.
They just want autonomy. And the Democrats are much more in this mindset of protectionism, of paternalism, because they're catering to people who the institutions have really, really worked for, either in the elites or if they're poor.
There's nothing worse than a dictator who thinks they're doing good for you. A benign dictator, benevolent dictator.
Yeah, a benevolent despot. But I mean, but in some ways, that would be even better, because at least they're not, like, constantly hitting you over the head with, like, you're racist, you're racist, I'm the good guy.
Oh,
I mean, one could imagine it's such a dictator easily.
It drives, yeah, that is what's happening. So how does this all link? And I wasn't actually going to ask you this, but because it's not in your book, but about we're a few miles away right now from Columbia. Is that what it's called? Just Columbia University? Not the country, but it's a few miles away from us now.
Mm.
We've talked about sort of how the woke has integrated itself into newspapers and publications. How has that had an effect on these campuses?
Oh, yeah, it's totally the same thing. I mean, people look at these campus protests, they think this is about, like, Israel and anti-Semitism. It's not. It's about the class divide. You've had such an amazing visual of this, which is the sort of discipline that the NYPD and the LAPD have brought to clearing these campus protesters, the hard work and the discipline of the American working class, and them trying to remove these young people who have been given every opportunity that their working class neighbors have not been given, and whose lives are assuredly going to be much better. And yet, what do they do with it? They have what I call oppression envy. Like, they envy the Palestinians their oppression, and so they masquerade as themselves oppressed.
Oh, my God. It's disgusting. It's like what I was saying about how they took over The Guardian, the New York Times, the people who've had everything. The more you think about it, it actually makes you sick. These privileged people and the way they treat the working class.
I was much angrier when I wrote my first book because I was in the thick of it, and it seemed like nothing was going to change. Now I feel a little bit more sanguine because I feel like it's so apparent. Like, everyone is looking at these kids like the miscreants that they are. I mean, like, you know, and it's just hilarious. They stand there in these little, like, you know, it's just hilarious. Like, it's so obviously not about the Palestinians. It's so obviously about their hatred of America and their contempt for America and the privilege that has been endowed on, like, the worst of us, you know. They're professors who have encouraged this from, it was so funny. So somebody interviewed one of these protesters and she said, I don't understand why I've been suspended. I literally got into Columbia by writing Columbia, you have to write an essay.
I saw this.
And she said, my essay was about how I led a walkout against Ron DeSantis in Florida, and that's why they took me. Like, did they think I wasn't going to do that here? It was so amazing. It was, like, so perfect. I mean, they deserve everything they get. But the real outrage here is not the anti-Semitism, which there is anti-Semitism. It's not that they're spoiled, which they are spoiled. It's not the cowering of the adults to the children, which is just disgusting. It's the real outrage is that these kids are assured the American dream. And the students and the kids and the Americans who have done everything right, who would never allow anti-Semitism to spread in this country the way it is in Europe, the way it is, I'm sorry, in England and in Canada and across the globe. The American people would never stand for that. I mean, 80% of Americans totally back Israel. This is so alien and foreign to American culture.
Yeah.
Yet they are struggling, and these kids are assured the American dream. That is an absolute outrage. It is so disgusting and unacceptable.
Struggling?
The working class, the people who have our backs, like the people who would never allow anti-Semitism to spread in America, they are struggling. And the people doing their utmost to make Americans hate Jews, they are assured the American dream. Like that is what this is about. It is a symptom of a much larger problem that absolutely has to be addressed. But I think a lot of people are sort of waking up to it this morning on the liberal channels. There was sort of like a sister soldier moment, people saying like, God, you guys, like, you got to stop with this. You're going to put Trump right back in power, which is like obviously the only thing they care about.
Yeah. Well, that's the only way you can, you know, bring people down from radicalization, I think. It's like, hey, we're on your side. It's just that this other bad thing is going to happen if we continue this way. I mean, you got Star of David on, Mogan David. I think you'd be okay in England in most places, but I wouldn't wear one now.
In England?
No.
Certainly not in Ireland. Forget about it.
Oh, fuck that. Ireland I've said this before.
Insane. It's
the oppressor-oppressed thing. Everyone I've ever known from Ireland has made some comment about me being Jewish. What? Why is that shocking?
Are you serious?
Yeah. Over the years, people I've worked with, when I worked at The Sun, kept trying to make, whenever there was an article about Israel, he'd like throw it in my face. And this, I'd never said anything about Israel at that point. I was quite a sort of a left-wing, you know, young whippersnapper at that point.
They're
do it. In Ireland, there is a lot of that. But they had one attack. Did you see that? Like 6 months ago, someone stabbed, and it was a Muslim person, I think, stabbed someone, a teacher. And the whole city burned, Dublin.
Dublin
just burned down. They couldn't handle it. And it was just this moment of like, right, so what if you were getting hundreds of rockets a day over periods of years and years?
You had one stabbing,
you burned down a refugee hotel. Like that's how people react when they're threatened.
It's so obvious. And like since October 7th, I've been saying like, I felt almost this like when, you know, the grief and the rage like abated a few months in, I started to feel this like euphoria because the ability to dispense with the fiction that the left is good, like the euphoria of being unburdened from this fiction that we all have to walk around and carry around and pretend. Like the minute you cannot tell the difference or who is the person worthy of sympathizing with between Shani Luke and her mangled, stripped-down body, and the people who did that to her, like, it's over. And, you know, there is this culture on, like, in some of the, like, social media, YouTube channels, blah, blah, blah. People, you know, are always saying, like, oh, all this anti-Semitism is spreading, you know, in the media. It's really not. The audience for these YouTube channels that have, like, massive followings that side with Hamas, like, they're global. I don't care what people in, you know, Jordan think about this. I don't care what people in Europe think about this. I only care about America. And thank God, like, it's just not spreading, despite the fact that the entire left-wing media wants the American people to side with Hamas, despite the fact that like these campus protests and so forth, they want this to look like it's spreading among young people. There was a poll that came out yesterday. 67% of young people, 18 to 24, support sending in the police to get rid of these protesters from American universities. This is not even a mainstream view among young people in this country. So I think that's important to point out.
When you say you only care about America, I mean, if you read in the paper tomorrow, like something happened to this young podcaster, got attacked in England, I know you're laughing with glee just thinking of it, but presumably that would be a very upsetting day. And, you know?
I mean, I could see myself being sad about that, but I'm responsible for this country. I'm an American, and I'm responsible for the well-being of this country. I'm a very America first person.
Look, like, America's responsible for a lot, though, and it's not a responsibility that America necessarily asked for, but it's the position it's in right now. You know, a lot of that like woke stuff, I mean, that comes from the US. You should see in the UK the stuff that we've got, like Black Lives Matter. We like don't have that many black people, and I think there's a better integrated. The issues we do have in the UK that are not so much here is the sort of Islam integration in the UK. So we have totally different, I mean, we have just as many issues, but they're totally different. Yeah. But the universities, as you can imagine, I mean, you can imagine what universities in the UK would be doing. They just bring in the same chants from the US universities, and it happens all around the world.
In fact, I think that the statistics for the media in England are actually even worse than here. So here, like, you know, 95% of journalists have a college degree. The majority have a graduate degree, and of them, certainly in the elite media spaces, the majority are from elite universities, but there are still people from sort of state schools. I think in the UK, the percentage of journalists who specifically went to Oxford and Cambridge is, it's upward of like 90%, 95%, something like that, 96%. I mean, it really is.
Not surprised.
Yeah.
Have you read The Status Game? Do you know of The Status Game, Will Storr?
The Status Game.
Is this theory? I don't know if it was initially Will's sort of theory or not, but he wrote this book called The Status Game, which changed how I think about so much of this stuff. And a lot of it was about how you gain status. And everybody's playing a different kind of status game, but we're all playing them, and we're incentivized. Everything we do, we're incentivized by gaining status. And there are three types. And I think the healthiest type is success. So if you were in a tribe evolutionarily, if you believe in evolution, do you believe in evolution? Right? Evolutionarily, if we're in a tribe, you made fire, you've made the wheel, everybody looks up to you, they give you more food and shelter, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. And from that, right, if you can't do that success, you're left with two others, which is either dominance or virtue. So you get bullies because they're not very successful at things. Mm-hmm. They are able to become the alpha male and get all the food, or alpha woman, get all the food and shelter because they're dominant and they bully people. If you're not a particularly dominant person, you're just left, the only way is virtue. Like, look how nice I am. But the trick is, you know, you're not actually necessarily nice. You just have to look nice to the rest of the tribe. And that's what a lot of, I think, the university students now, they're not that good at stuff. They've gone to Princeton or wherever they are, but they're with a bunch of other people who also went to Princeton. So how do they stand out in their tribe?
I feel like a successful person wrote this.
I don't actually know anything about Will's, because he's been on the show, so I don't want to intimate anything about his finances or anything like that. But I would say an embittered writer wrote this.
I think that we've sort of, as a culture, as we've sort of dispossessed the working class economically, mainstream American culture has become defined by the left, and in opposition to like traditional forms of masculinity. So there's been a kind of cultural and psychological warfare on the working class, on brawn, on masculinity, on machismo, on men as providers. They effectively criminalized like trying to mate with women in the way that had been sort of sanctioned for most of human history, and by turning it into, you know, it's now considered basically like, you know, assault to hit on somebody, harassment and so forth. And all of these things contributed to weighting society and culture and political power in favor of a much more feminized version of society and culture. And
which is virtue.
Which is sort of like, we're not going to have dominance, right? You're not going to be able to keep order through like physically setting boundaries, and instead you'll sort of lord it over people. Like, I probably shouldn't say this, but these protests on college campuses are being led by like women and they thems, right? Like, they're not actually scary. Like, the idea that Jewish students are not safe on college campuses, I think, is really a crime against Jewish history. Like, these people
aren't
are not
usually sort of aggressive Antifa people who come and join.
No, well, there were a few, but they were really like, they in the Columbian sense, they came right at the end, which is why Mayor Eric Adams, you know, it was a big part of why the NYPD was mobilized. They sensed like a shift in tactic. I mean, you don't have to believe them that happened, but that does seem like it happened. Like, it does seem like the students started it and then some professionals came in. But the professionals who came in were professional protesters. It wasn't like Seattle. It wasn't Antifa type people. Like, you know, they're not physically violent. They're not physically scary. The thing that to me was the most intimidating about them is, and I've been protested, so I know it's like you see it up close and it's really intimidating because they look like zombies. They won't make eye contact. They won't talk to you. They will just chant and stare off in the distance. And that is very scary. Like, there's something, because you feel like you're in a horror movie. Like, it's like, talk to me, be a human. And they have really suspended their humanity to you because you're part of like the evil and the bad guys and so forth. But to say that you're unsafe from such people, I mean, they're physical cowards. They're not actually... And that, I think, has to do with this whole, like, you know, the shift from, you know, like, you just cannot compare this to, like, Dr. King and what he was trying to accomplish, which was to appeal to the mainstream, to the average person, and say, I know you are good. I know you are better than what you think you are, which is a racist, what you think you have to believe. And that was unbelievably effective, the whole nonviolent model. But also it was built on the idea of sustaining blows, like of sustaining physical attacks against yourself. It was a very sort of like noble, elevated form of trying to win sympathy from like the mainstream. This is like the exact opposite of that. They do not want to convince the mainstream. Just like they've turned on Dr. King's vision, right? Now it's like racist to want to live in a colorblind society, you know? They have also turned on the idea of like a two-state solution. They want an intifada. And like, it's like, you're not going to get Americans to want that. They know that. They do not want to convince people. They want to be part of a small elite that can lord it over everybody else, that they are the ones with the right ideology. And this is like totally out of Thomas Wolfe's book, Radical Chic. He argued that like an elite has to consolidate its elite status. And the way you do that is you have to show your distance from like the lame middle, like the lame middle class, right? Because otherwise, how did people know that you're part of an elite? There was this movement in France called Nostalgie de la Boue in the 19th century. And it was when like women who were upper middle class, you know, who were striving to portray themselves kind of to adopt, you know, as the elites, right? They would adopt the dress code of like the maidens, of the like people who like labored, as a way of saying like, you know, we're not part of the middle classes who are striving to be clean and educated and cultivated. You know, we are above such things. In fact, we are so distinct from the middle class that we are actually... Boo means mud. We're going to roll around in the mud. And you see so much of that now in the leftist culture, which is now that the American middle class has finally become like totally non-racist, like totally past all that horrible stuff from our history, totally embracing the values this country was founded on, they had to then turn on that. On the good stuff, on the real like rejection of racism, rejection of anti-Semitism, and embrace like the ideology of the mud in order to show how different they are from the middle class.
Right, you get. I see your nostalgie de la boue, and I raise you ostalgie in Germany, where they the nostalgia for the Ost or East. Among the middle classes. So it was better before when we had no freedom and that kind of thing. Like, you know.
Totally. Yeah.
This is something I've been thinking about with regards to what you just said. Mm-hmm. For a long time, you were supposed to call people who are black colored, right? That was the polite way to say it these years ago, colored people. And then it became taboo. That was you're not supposed to say that. You just say black. And people say, I'm not colored. And there were all these kinds of graphics of like, what am I? Yellow and pink and multicolored and those kinds of things. Well, okay, I understand that. You think you're black. You're black, we'll say that. And for a long time in the UK, we used to have, every now and then there'd be like a sports pundit or something who didn't like get the memo. Yeah. And would use the wrong word and would be just killed for it. And we loved it. We all reveled in it. And what we were really reveling in was like, you're so old fashioned. You've not kept up with the latest trends. There was no suggestion this person's a racist, that they don't like people of different skin colors or anything like that. It was just they had the wrong word and they were stupid and they should know better. We finally reached a point about 4 years ago where I think everyone in Britain, at least, probably everyone in America, but all 70 million people in Britain, everyone knew, do not say colored. You're supposed to say black. Every single person knew that. And then they changed it back to off color to catch them out again so that everyone could be caught out.
It's so true. And I remember poor Benedict Cumberbatch had a moment where he accidentally said colored people.
Oh, because of right, and I bet at that moment loads of people cheered.
People went crazy at him, and like, because obviously, like, what is the difference between colored and of color? It's, you're right. I always say that it's okay. So in England, I think this is accurate, but basically, people's accents tell you a lot about their socioeconomic background. Like, you can pinpoint based on someone's accent within 20 miles where they're from and guess how much money their father makes, right?
To an extent, yes. I mean, yes. I remember having this conversation because class is so integral to everything in England with my dad in the car. I must have been like 16. And I was just trying to understand issues around class and things. And I remember saying, Dad, are we posh? And he said, well, you are. And I was like, oh, okay, we're different things, are we? Well,
that's
I don't
hilarious.
Like this. Yeah, my dad got all woke on me, I suppose.
So he sent you to a posh school?
Yeah. Yeah, and he was very proud to do it. Yeah, I mean, there was a very, especially like among Jews, but other minorities, I guess, this idea of the American dream, but in the UK or wherever it is, and sending your kid to one of those schools. Now, I've been to that school. I'm not sure I would. Well, firstly, I couldn't afford to send my kids to a school like that because the prices have gone bananas now. Mm. Ridiculous what those school prices are now. But,
Also, they need to keep up all the upstarts, you know?
There aren't so many Jews at those schools now anymore, you know, because the sort of Jewish middle class can't afford them. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how ridiculous that is. I don't want to go into who can, because then it's like I'm saying, oh, look at these rich minorities or whatever it is. There are far fewer Jewish kids in England going to those private schools now. But that was my first sort of understanding. But go on. What were you saying about that?
Well, I was going to say, so in America, we have accents, but they're regional.
Yeah.
And so instead, we need things like, you know, how do you prove that you're from the elites, that you've gotten the right education? So we have stupid words like Latinx, you know, which proves you went to one of these stupid schools and got this stupid education. And they have to, that control of the language, the control of the pronouns, you know, like granting a child the right to lecture a grown-up, like, from the get-go, right? Like, what is the pronoun thing about? It's about giving a child, from the get-go, they are introduced to an adult who they should have some kind of, you know, polite and deference, whatever, and giving them the right to say, no, you are on the wrong side. I get to lecture you. It's this, like, reversal of power dynamics that is, it's really contrary to, you know, middle-class values, religious values, like, functioning society, like a civilized society where, like, you know, kids have a little bit of respect. That's a whole, there's this like worship of youth culture, and like it's totally tied to the latest language. Like, who is deciding what the latest terminology is? It's like kids on TikTok, you know,
think of like Mao and stuff like that. They went for the kids.
I was going to say that,
They went for the kids. And then the parents had to like shut up around their kids.
Right, or the kids like beating their parents in the struggle sessions, right? Like, is there anything more horrifying to like a person with like any kind of morality? But
What's a struggle session?
A struggle session? Mm. So in Maoist China, what they would do is if somebody did a wrong thing, they would gather the whole town or the whole class or whatever, and they would put like a big dunce cap on them and a sign around them that said, you know, I had a bad thing, and they would beat them up, you know, and they would have to confess their sins. And you see this now happening like on college camps. I mean, this was like de rigueur during the 2020 George Floyd, you know, people would effectively be, you know, defenstered from their jobs for wrong thing and then have to go through these struggle sessions effectively. With their colleagues and like beg forbearance and forgiveness. And it was disgusting.
It's absolutely bonkers, this whole thing. Use a lot of, you've got a lot of Frenchisms.
Do I?
Yeah. De rigueur.
Oi. Oi,
de la boue.
Oi, oi, oi.
Oh yeah, we've gone Yiddish now out of fear.
Got to bring it back to the
working. Bring it back for the working class. Do not be speaking that way. But what I was going to say is,
it's the unconscious effect your accent is having on me. It's like
I think I'm French.
No, but I've fallen into this like, you know, this register.
Yes,
my book, which.
How do you talk when you talk when you're interviewing people for the book?
My book is not like this at all. It's very accessible, which was really important to me.
It is. There's no French at all in it, except in the French translations, I can only presume. I like the accents here. You do have some sort of accents, and there's what I always do this, and I wonder, is it sort of a posh one or a lower class one? That one that goes, I do declare.
Well, so in the South, it's really interesting because you actually do have that. Like in Savannah, for example, there is a big class divide in the accents. There's the kind of like rich old family, old school Savannah accent. Yes. And then the kind of the South was much more like class divided than the North. You know, this whole idea of like America being this like entrepreneurial place where, you know, there's sort of like, no, anybody can make it, whatever. Like in the South, it was like a kind of much more, you know, old fashioned aristocratic kind of obviously built on slavery and so forth. And then, you know, it's funny. Even in the black culture in the South, there's also like the regional accents are very extreme. They're really interesting. Yeah,
I can't do impressions of those though.
I would recommend against it.
No, and that's, you know, that's how it is. I can accept that. That's one of the things. But look, one of the things that you found when you went around meeting the working class people and was, you know, they do tend to be pro gay. That was interesting.
Yeah. Super pro-gay.
But anti-woke.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all the things that I think the elites think of these people, it's just utter nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, it's total.
And they don't want...
Bollocks.
Bollocks. They're total bollocks. Better than the French. What would they have said? Je sais pas de rigueur. So they don't want handouts. And well, Is there a way to make universities in the States? Because that isn't, that's expensive. They're so expensive.
Well, there's a lot of state schools that are affordable.
Is that right?
Hmm.
Well, it's all good then. Where can people find your work? Where do you want to send them? You've got two books. Do you want to talk about both? Sort of say which?
Yeah,
called?
Yeah. Buy my books.
Yep.
I would love that.
What are they both called?
The one that I'm promoting now is called Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And the first one is called Bad News.
Brilliant. read the one she said before. Don't read the bad news. What? Look, get. It doesn't matter. It's called Bad News.
How woke media is undermining democracy?
That's it. That's it. Get the book. I need to ask you, who's a heretic you admire?
Who's a heretic that I admire? Spinoza, obviously.
Okay.
Alive today? Who's Spinoza?
I'm a journalist.
You're a Jewish atheist. How do you not know who Spinoza is?
You're like the comment section for YouTube. That's, how do you not know this? I have to ask people so they explain to others who don't know.
But you have heard of Spinoza?
Maybe. Certainly not going to admit to not knowing who he is now, or she. Now tell me, or they, who's Spinoza?
A living heretic who I admire is my father.
Oh. That's nice.
Yeah.
Okay, and tell me about Spinoza. Seriously, do give me a line about Spinoza.
Well, Spinoza was a Jewish philosopher living in the 15th or 16th century in Amsterdam, I believe. And he was a heretic. He started this idea of pantheism, that God is in nature, that there is no, he sort of took on the whole Jewish community, and he was ousted from the Jewish community and he was not allowed to live in the Jewish community anymore. And that could be very painful. I've, you know, run foul of my community before, and it's very painful. I admire his courage, although I admire his courage.
Right. I felt like there was another thought there that you didn't say.
Well, he had this idea of the Konitas. I'm not going there. You're trying to like make me out to be this like elitist.
Tell me about Spinoza and tell me in French. I want an essay in French. I want a dissertation.
Well, the best parts of Nietzsche came from Spinoza.
Thank you for joining us on this talk about the different classes and the underclass of America. Now tell me more about Nietzsche and Spinoza, please. What did Sartre say?
You're so dangerous.
Tell me about Marx and the manifesto. Right, we're done. People, seriously, right. Batya's books are amazing. She's a brilliant writer.
He hasn't read them.
I have read them, and they're great. And she talks, it is important. I'm laughing, but it is important. So please do go and get her books. Thank you, Batya Ungersaar. Go on, what a brilliant, brilliant episode that was. And it was a lot of fun. She's a really fun person. And I think that's important, because we can get a bit bogged down otherwise when we've got, I've done hundreds of episodes, and if they're all just like very serious voices talking about very serious things, well, you know, who can just listen to that all the time? I think there are ways to put out really interesting points and expose wrongdoings in the media and among our elites and things, and to also hopefully have a good time in some respects while doing so. I hope you guys feel that way anyway, and it wasn't just, you know, that it's not always just a lecture, that we're all just lecturing you about stuff and that it's interesting. Do go and get Batya's brilliant, brilliant book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. Get hold of mine, The Psychology of Secrets, My Adventures with Murderers, Cults and Influencers, and give us both a whole bunch of reviews. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.